probably most of us, who come to Dharma practice, probably are hoping for some good stuff to happen, I suspect. Probably nobody gets into Dharma practice without thinking like, oh yeah, so you know, my mind and heart will open. And that kind of gives us a funny relationship to the effort we make and the pretty clear and consistent teaching that somehow that effort also has to incorporate non-attachment. So this can be kind of tricky. How do we make an effort that isn't co-opted by self-clinging? So there are quite a few different perspectives on this in the Buddhist world. In Japan, as you know, this kind of gave rise to a lengthy discussion, many, many, many years, centuries really, of trying to figure out the balance between so-called self-power and so-called other power. And usually in East Asia, the Chan and Zen tradition is associated with self-power, or jiriki, it's called in Japanese. And the Pure Land tradition is associated with tariki, or other power. And the distinction there is because our world, from one point of view, is so corrupt, we need to rely on the power of, for instance, Amitabha Buddha, whose limitless vow is to create and maintain an environment where Dharma practice is completely unhindered. And probably we might be tempted, probably we would be willing to admit that our present world doesn't exactly look like that. In other words, most of us encounter one degree or another of hindrance in our practice. So, because things are just so rotten, we have to call upon the saving power of Amitabha Buddha, among others, who will help us achieve a body in an environment where Dharma practice is just a breeze. That's all that happens all the time. The only sounds you hear are the sounds of Dharma and your wonderful aromas and heavenly music. And meanwhile, this immense vow of Amitabha Buddha is bringing everyone's practice to fruition. So this is a story about other power. And then by contrast, the Chan and Zen traditions present the picture of the sometimes rather grim-faced practitioner on his or her cushion, grinding away at meditation practice or Zen stories, koans, etc. And manifesting this enormous jiviki, self-power. Right? So as with so many things in Buddhism, it's kind of neither exactly one or the other. Both stories, if we kind of cling to their viewpoint, turn out to have associated problems. If we actually think that by manifesting intense practice and going to many, many, many retreats and mastering many Zen stories and so forth, we can actually bring about our own awakening. Usually at some point people find that that story has to be relinquished in order for the genuine body-mind of practice to arise unhindered, as though this were the Pure Land. And similarly, in Pure Land practice, people who go on retreats to recite the Buddha's name, Japanese Namo Amida Butsu, or Chinese Namo Amida Fo, and to recite hundreds and thousands of times the name of Amida Buddha, discover that somehow the effort of the individual practitioner is merging with the vow of Amitabha Buddha. So lo and behold, there is self-power mixed in with other power. And on the Zen side, there's other power mixed in with self-power. So those of you who have been on maybe especially Zen retreats perhaps have noticed that maybe if it's a difficult schedule, there are periods where you're not sure how you're going to get through the next sitting, even, let alone the rest of the retreat. And sometimes, if in that space we kind of just sort of let things go and say, well, you know what, if I die or collapse in this retreat, then so be it. I'm just going to keep going back to the Zendo and eating the meals and so forth. Another kind of energy arises that is not, exactly under your control. So what is that? Is that the power of Amida's vow? Well, maybe. So it's kind of neither exactly one nor the other. And this brings a little focus to the question of is the cause of awakening what we do, and is the effect enlightenment? So this is just one of many questions that Buddhists have been examining for a very long time. Our old friend Dogen Zenji, 13th century Zen master from Japan, he goes on at some length about this question. It's like, how exactly is this working? Do we, the practitioners, exert the cause and then joyfully reap the effect? Is that how it works? Or is the quality of awakening some sort of something that just kind of arises spontaneously? So over the centuries, different periods of time, people have assumed that indeed, enlightenment is the effect, and our effort is the cause. Others have assumed that the innate quality of the mind, of the body-mind of the practitioner, is such that, for instance, the notion that the mind somehow is somehow constantly in the realm of awakening, and the body is just kind of this adventitious thing that pops up and goes away from time to time. So in other words, the mind is constantly somehow in enlightenment, and the body is just this temporary phenomenon. Now, that may not sound all that unreasonable. After all, what about the doctrine of Hongaku, or original awakening? Doesn't that mean that the mind of awakening is always present, and the body of the practitioner just arises and passes away according to the collusion of various circumstances? And in fact, some also believe that when people die, the mind simply returns to some ocean of enlightenment. And in fact, oddly enough, even in funeral services, such as we encounter in our own tradition, there's a way of addressing the deceased as though he or she were now, in fact, they use the term sometimes, in pari nirvana. So all the deceased had to do was die and is carried away on the ocean of awakening. Now, this is a very odd kind of idea, given the fact that Dogen Zenji quite explicitly contradicts this notion and says, actually, no, that's not how it works. And in illustrating this interesting point, he brings up a very famous Zen story, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Has anybody not heard of the so-called fox koan? Oh, a few people have not heard of the fox. Okay, all right. Well, as I say, it's a very well-known story and involves some very famous figures, among them the great Tang Dynasty master, Baijiang Huaihai, and also one of his disciples, the equally towering Huangbo. Anyway, the way the story is usually told, Baijiang was an abbot at his community, at his monastery, and whenever he would give a Dharma talk, there was an old gent who was always in the back somewhere, kind of in the dark, so Baijiang could never quite see him, and he would always leave right away after the talk. Except one day, for some reason, this gent did not leave. And so Baijiang goes up and asks him, so who are you? What are you doing here? And the fellow says, well, actually, I'm not human. I used to practice on this mountain, and in fact, I was in charge of a community, and one day someone asked me a Dharma question, and I actually, because of my answer, I was doomed to be reborn 500 times as a fox. Some of you may know that the so-called a wild fox spirit in Zen is a trickster figure who tends to present Dharma in a way that's actually off and is not helpful to people. So this poor chap was destined to be reborn 500 times, and so Baijung says, oh, well, so what was the question? And the guy says, someone asked me, does the great sage, the great adept, come under cause and effect or not? And I said, nah, doesn't. And that was the end for me. So I've been coming back again and again and again, hundreds of births as a fox as a result. And so the gentleman says, so I am asking you, Master Baijung, would you please give me a turning word that will release me from this curse? So Baijung says, okay, ask me the question. So the guy says, does the sage come under, fall under cause and effect or not? And Baijung very tersely says, do not ignore cause and effect. And lo and behold, the guy is liberated. He says, thank you very much. I am no longer having to be reborn as a fox. And as a matter of fact, if you'll go up behind the monastery, there's a big rock back there, and you'll find my body. And if you would be so kind as to perform the funeral obsequies for a monk, I would be grateful. So Baijung, Master Baijung, has the monastery director hit the bell, summon everyone, and announce that there's going to be a funeral. So he leads them out there behind the monastery, and sure enough, they come to this rock outcropping, and there's the body of a fox. So they have a cremation ceremony and so forth. And Baijung explains what this is all about to the community. After he's done explaining, his disciple Huangbo comes up and says, well, what if he hadn't given the wrong answer? And Baijung says, come here a minute and I'll tell you. Yeah. So, of course, in Zen, this is already like, whoa, wait a minute. So Huangbo goes up and smacks Baijung. And Baijung claps and says, this peculiar remark about barbarians with red beards. Like, oh, I knew that barbarians had red beards, but here is a red-bearded barbarian. Right? Now, that may sound a little mysterious to you, but the notion is that people from the far west, the source lands of Buddha Dharma, did not look like the Chinese. They were tended to be paler, and the legends around the first Chan or Zen ancestor in China was that he actually was pale and had red hair and blue eyes and a red beard. So that's this business about red-bearded barbarians. So Dogen goes on at some length about this teaching and says, we should be careful about our relationship to cause and effect, and not be confused by thinking, for instance, that someone else will save us, or that the mind of awakening is as a result of our splendid and spotless effort. So the contrasting positions are, one, does the sage, which kind of means you guys, fall into cause and effect, or does the sage simply get to, you know, blow it off and say, oh, that doesn't affect us because we're practitioners. And Dogen winds up saying the full-bodied, faithful practice of the Buddha way means you don't fall in and you don't ignore. Right? Neither falling into cause and effect, nor ignoring cause and effect. Now, what does that look like? Anybody? Did you just snicker, Oscar?
There's no managing cause and effect.
No managing cause and effect? Mm-hmm.
You recognize it after it happens, not before.
Okay. But so how did one practice that? How does that show up as an actual body-mind? Yes?
Well, he talks about like this exertion of a single thing or something, like you throw yourself in totally to what you're doing.
Yes.
I don't know how to do that, but that's what he says.
Right. You don't know how to do that, and neither do I. Mm-hmm. This is the point, actually. If, in fact, we really do throw the entire body-mind into practice of the Buddha way, we don't know what we're doing. We don't know how that's done. Right? This is where the golden fingers of other powers start to creep into this practice. So, for instance, when we're doing our cross-legged sitting, what is our effort like? This is really a crucial question. And it's so easy to start, for instance, especially early in practice, our effort tends to be pretty crude and muscular. Now, there are some styles of practice that all but encourage that. Right? And, well, that's not our style. Or anyway, it's not my style. Maybe it's your style. But basically, what usually happens is that at some point in the exertion of an overly muscular practice, people come to recognize that's just exhausting. That's just exhausting to do that. So what if it were possible to arrange the body-mind in a posture, a gesture, a balance, and give oneself over completely to the phenomenal arisings of sitting and breathing and basically not doing anything at all? I think that's really kind of tough for a lot of us, because it really means surrendering totally to what is arising in the moment and following as much as we can the instructions of the Buddhas and ancestors to inhabit this person, whatever it is, completely. Sitting in stillness, breathing in, breathing out, without trying to lasso cause and effect or pretend it has no bearing. This is what we call zazen. Yes, sir.
And I would add, you have to be willing to put up and recognize a lot of claiming of experience as you're doing it. You know, in other words,
did you say claiming?
Claiming.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just have, you're just sitting there, but something happens, and then
you want to claim it.
In
a way, you want to fall into cause and effect.
Yeah,
it's very, very tempting all the time. Why? Because that's our karmic tendency. This whole body-mind is a manifestation of cause and effect. Now, where this gets really slippery is, didn't the great Acharya Nagarjuna teach that there wasn't cause and effect? Well, actually, yeah. Chapter 17 of the Root Verses of the Middle Way in Nagarjuna is pellucid but extremely dense Sanskrit, basically says, yeah, it's not that there is no cause and effect, but there is no literal cause and effect. There is no ultimate cause and effect. This is where Nagarjuna's teaching is like a scalpel, right? Very keenly cutting through our misconceptions. Because it would be silly to say there's no cause and effect at all. But to say that ultimately there's no cause and effect, why? Because if there were to be such, there would have to be such a thing as objects and persons existing from their own side. And there is no such thing. Or better yet, go try and find such a thing and see what you come up with. So, to have tremendous faith in cause and effect means take our seat, take our place as practitioners, practice completely wholeheartedly, and allow that to be the cause. Just allow it to be. And the effect, if you like, becomes not your concern any longer. This is, you know, one way of talking about what we call zazen. And, you know, it's kind of like you know, you sit down and you have an inkling of how much is at stake, so to speak. It's like crawling out on a limb. Dimly, you hear the sound of sawing behind you. it's kind of challenging to have such complete trust that you don't need to add anything or take anything away from your practice moment by moment. Right? And really, it's kind of scary. It's like, I'm just sitting here, and what if nothing happens? It's like, no, you've got to, our trust has to be more profound than that. Our trust that the description that the Buddhas and ancestors gave us of how cause and effect works in practice, we can trust that completely. So we don't have to sit around falling into cause and practice by cause and effect by manipulating what we think of as the correct causes. We don't have to do that. We don't have to pretend that cause and effect has no bearing. We can avoid both of those mistaken positions and take our place in practice wholeheartedly. And doesn't matter if fear arises. Doesn't matter if doubt arises. Our magnificent spiritual heart can carry us straight through all that, right? Without trying to get rid of it, without trying to cling to it. Just this body-mind practice, moment after moment after moment. That is the ungraspable cause. And the ungraspable effect, sometimes people call awakening. So this is, you know, I don't know of any particularly comparable, maybe there is some school of thought in Western philosophy. If so, I'm not familiar with it. This notion from particularly Indian Buddha Dharma, this radical declaration that things have no ultimate existence. Not provisional existence. Yes, they do have that. But ultimate existence? No. Things have no fixed nature from their own side. This is quite an extraordinary thing to claim. And, of course, Nagarjuna, in his tremendous skill, reminds us over and over again that this is not a philosophical position. Okay? the true practitioners of the middle way, as Buddhism is sometimes called, do not take philosophical positions. Right? And in fact, Nagarjuna's great work, in particular, the root verses of the middle way, demonstrates over and over again how philosophical positions, which are based on the assumption of things existing from their own side, can all be brought to absurdity. Right? He does this over and over again. Right? He even has a chapter on how the Four Noble Truths do not have ultimate existence from their own side. Right? This is amazing. This is a Buddhist saying, wait a minute, the Four Noble Truths have... And another chapter on how the Tathagata, the Buddha himself, has no ultimate existence. Right? This guy was a radical. Right? And that strain of radical practice manifests again, or continues to manifest, even in Dogen, you know, 1,000 years later. It's still happening. Right? This is quite amazing stuff when you get right down to it. And what we call Zazen is an invitation to take our seat in the midst of vast uncertainty, right? A universe vastly ungraspable. And urging us again and again, don't try and manipulate cause and effect, and don't pretend you're free of it. Right? Never mind either of those. Just straightforward practice. Right? Let the cause be the cause, and the effect be effect. Right? Without messing with that. And basically, the same whatever it is, perspective or attitude, is succinctly manifested in our instructions for practice. Whether they are, you know, from our local Zazen instruction, guy or gal, or in the beautiful, all the beautiful Chinese and Japanese poems we have about practice, the instructions for practice basically all come back to this ungraspable, still place. That's what you guys are doing. Or some of you. Now, this tradition exists in one way or another all across Buddhism. This is not the unique purview, the unique perspective only of the Zen folks. Right? You find it in Tibetan Buddhism, even in what some people regard as the genuine words and teaching of Buddha as exemplified in the Pali scriptures, for instance. You can actually, I've met Theravadan practitioners, monastics and non-monastics, who actually, if you, you know, pin them down a little bit, you can actually hear, you know what, they're actually doing Zazen too. Even though they're, you know, you've got all of these techniques of meditation and so forth, and yet you get right down to it. The most experienced practitioners, it sounds like they're just doing Zazen, even though the vocabulary is different. Right? So this, whatever this is manifesting, you know, century after century, generation after generation in the practice of Buddha Dharma, and, you know, probably not even exclusively there either. Probably all of you, if you were kind of a religion nut like I was from, you know, a young age, you probably meet people in all kinds of spiritual traditions, and if you talk to them, you start to realize, oh my God, they're doing it too, actually. Yeah, the vocabulary is different, but the heart, you can actually feel that, right? Which is why often when monastics get together of various traditions, they're right away, they're like buds. Hey, they like recognize each other. The theologians, not so much. But the practitioners, they actually recognize each other. They recognize that heart in one another. You know, it's pretty amazing. And this is what I think I've seen. Of course, I could be nuts. But anyway, they asked me to give a talk, so I thought I would. So this is just one way of talking about practice. And this body-mind bridges this funny kind of disconnect between, yes, there's cause and effect, oh, but actually, no. That's not fair. But anyway, the bridge is here. This is the bridge, right there. You guys are all the bridge. That's pretty good news, I think. And sure, what about, you know, what if we doubt? What if we have doubts? It's like, that's okay. Let the doubt come up and manifest and let it transform into something else. Do not harbor it and, you know, try to kill it or, you know, make it do something else. Just let it be. Have such deep trust that you can let doubt come up and manifest. And it does not faze you. One of the challenges in probably, you know, all over all kinds of spirituality, but I'm thinking particularly a while back I spoke with one of the instructors at the Roman Catholic Diocesan Seminary in Menlo Park. Very, very sweet man. And he was kind of, he was lamenting that the generation of priest trainees that he was encountering, he said they were, for reasons I'm still not clear, I don't know why people from the Philippines and Vietnam and various other places, South America and so forth, were coming, I don't understand why they were coming to this diocesan seminary for their training, but they were. And this instructor was saying, for many of them, they were coming from a tradition of spirituality where doubt was absolutely forbidden. Right? It was forbidden. They did not know how to interact with their doubt in a way that was actually helpful. Basically, you were not allowed to question. And he would try in his classes to say, well, you know, what about that? Maybe that's kind of off base. What do you think? Oh, No, the faith is straightforward and you never question it. It's like, actually, that inflexibility will wind up being a tremendous burden. If that person, these are all men in this case, becomes a priest, he is going to have a lot of trouble relating to people, lay folks, people with ordinary lives, for whom doubt is a serious challenge. And they will not have encountered that challenge in their own body. How are they supposed to help? By telling them, don't you dare question anything? It's like, that's not going to work. Right? That is a very, very brittle and unworkable, ultimately, position. Right? Why? Because doubt always comes up. So what? No big deal. Right? Everybody's light can illuminate doubt. Not eliminate, illuminate doubt. Right? In the process of this kind of wholehearted practice of the way, light, doubt is light. You can actually see it as light itself. Right? But if your relationship to doubt is like, oh, don't even mention that word to me, then it's like a permanent cramp. Right? You cannot allow yourself to question anything. Right? So it's like, well, we don't teach that, you know? Let the questions come up. But then meet those questions with this powerful body, mind, and spirit of practice. Right? Just being upright. Is it doubt? Is it certainty? Is it uncertainty? You know, none of that actually matters in the way that our habits would lead us to think. This is how we trust cause and effect, and we don't fall into it. So I'm starting to wonder if I'm making any sense at all. Maybe not. If not, I apologize. But this is what kind of occurred to me to talk about. So please, if you have some doubts, let's surface them, bring them out. Or if you have questions or comments, please. Yes?
Well, I've heard several talks on that. I love your talk, but.
But.
The back and forth between the wild fox spirit
mm-hmm.
monk and is it Baijiang?
Baijiang, uh-huh.
Yeah. So the wild fox has said no cause and effect, and then he somehow, I guess this is, but he somehow needs Baijiang to release him from the wild fox body, and yet that's also a...
That's a little funny.
Yeah. But they seem to be acting as one person. I mean, he was the former abbot, as I understand it.
Yes.
And then Baijiang is the present abbot.
Right.
So there are these lives, and yet it's one life.
Exactly. There are actual lives, and yet it's one life. That's a good way to put it. Mm-hmm. So again, well, which is it? Is it, you know, one life or actual individual lives? What, which is it? Well, actually, neither of the extremes will be helpful. It's actually neither one nor the other exactly. So how do we find our way through that? This body, mind, and spirit, that's how. This body, mind, and spirit that is like a, as Dogen says, you know, it's like sailing a boat out in the ocean. And you're so far out on the ocean, there is no land in sight. So, as Dogen says in one of his magnificent flights of fancy, you don't know, is the ocean, it looks round. Everybody knows the ocean's not round. It's not square either. So, you know what? Keep sailing. Keep sailing. And sailing is another word for practice or sitting. Sailors, all of you. This is great. Yeah, you get seasick sometimes, but yes.
I was wondering, if you keep bringing up doubt. Yeah.
Well, I wasn't looking at it as a bridge per se. I was looking at it as another phenomenal manifestation, which one neither needs to reject nor hang on to. Right? That means trust it. Trust the doubt. Right? Now I'm sure y'all know there's a traditional list of 5 meditative hindrances. And one of them is vichikitsa in Sanskrit. But it's a particular kind of doubt. Okay, and we've talked about this before, but I just want to reiterate. Vichikitsa is skeptical doubt, or as I like to call it, corrosive doubt. It's the doubt that sneers at practice. Right? Now, that's not the same as doubt that questions. This is doubt that simultaneously questions and rejects. It's like, a lot of malarkey, you know, boo, you know. Skeptical doubt is a hindrance. Regular, good old human doubt? No, not so much. Yes?
It occurs to me that doubt is actually the manifestation of an unanswered question.
Or could be.
The kind of skeptical doubt that you talk about is actually a conclusion. A preconception.
Prejudged conclusion,
yeah.
A priori, yeah. Mm-hmm. You could say so. Yeah. Yeah. Skeptical doubt saps the energy of practice. And that's not so helpful. But the doubt that, you know, in Zen they have this thing of great doubt. Great doubt is not skeptical doubt. Great doubt is simply the questioning body-mind, you know. Is this the Buddha way? Is this reality? Without having to have an answer. And that's different from skeptical doubt, which is like dismissive. That's another name for it, dismissive doubt.
It doesn't keep me from wanting an answer.
Hmm?
It doesn't keep me from wanting an answer.
What doesn't keep you from?
great doubt, you know.
Great doubt does not keep you
from wanting the answer.
No, well, it's okay. Wanting the answer is not a problem. But how about don't fall into it and don't reject it either?
Well, I realize the possibility that mm-hmm. I simply will not get it.
Oh, you'll get it. Oh, you're going to get it, man.
You say that now.
I say that. I do. I do. Of course, I don't mean to say you haven't gotten it already. You just, you know, you're just kicking things around here. Yes.
So I have a T-shirt that was with calligraphy by Reb Anderson
yeah.
that I was told the translation is deep belief in.
Jinjininga. Yes, that's the one.
What you're talking about. So yeah. It's not exactly belief.
It's more like trust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Deep trust in cause and effect. Right. So deep that you fall below the level of jumping in or rejecting.
But it's not like linear. We usually think of cause and effect.
As linear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's you might say it's conventionally linear, but not ultimately. Right. This is this whole, you know, really, really sly business that Buddhists came up with. There's two truths. It's like, oh, come on. It'd be two truths. Yes, yes, there are two truths. Conventional truth, which is like just the way the world looks, kind of. And ultimate truth, which is there are no fixed natures. It's like, whoa, man, that's kind of amazing. Yeah, it is. It's kind of amazing. Gosh, it's so quiet. The sitting was very quiet, too. Very impressive. Except for my stomach, which was grumbling horribly. So I apologize. But other than that, I didn't hear anything. So maybe that meant that, you know, we were all sitting there with this body and mind of complete trust. In practice, the cause was happening. And, of course, as Dogen says, the effect, awakening, or what he calls verification, that is happening at the same time. Right? So in this way, it's not linear. It's like, I practice so that I can be awakened. No. Dogen says, no, that is words fail me, but it's like a perfect sphere, right? It's not that practice leads to awakening. Practice manifests the body mind of awakening already. And if you can trust that completely, well, we just say, well, that's zazen. Great. You don't even have to consciously keep going, I trust this, I trust that. You know, it's not like that. You manifest trust with your body. It's kind of cool. Well, I have a frightful headache, so I'm tempted to kind of, you know, say, well, maybe you all want to go home now. Actually, my head was bothering me a lot during sitting, too, but it's also kind of cool to, in the midst of some considerable discomfort, manifest this trust. It's like, okay, it's all right. I don't have to get rid of that. I don't have to fall into it. I can just sit here. It's pretty amazing. And you can all do that, except that you don't exactly do it. Okay? It is done. If you start to think like, I'm doing this, then, whoops, sounds like you're falling into cause and effect again. Okay? It is done, but you're not necessarily doing it. That's a Zen way of putting things. Anything else? Are you about to ask a question? No. Okay. All right. Well, it was lovely to see you all. Please keep up the splendid work. And the cause and the effect are in our hands. So let's take care. Thank you very much.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are countless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.